for the human family we demand it. Just us, truth, freedom, equality's a must. Us, decolonization of the planet, so bust this. People be the power, now we build the justice. Pointing at system divinations, how we build the justice. Welcome to planet to the podcast, build the justice. Build the justice, build the justice, build. Is to add on or do away with justice.
Welcome to Building Justice, a podcast by Sacramento State's Center on Race, Immigration, and Social Justice, otherwise known as CRISJ. We explore critical issues affecting our communities with the hopes of creating a healthier and more just world. I am Professor Christina Flores-Victor, and I am here with Professor Chris Taller. We are both professors in the Political Science Department here on the Sac State campus. And today we have the pleasure of speaking with California Assemblymember Kevin McCarty. Today we will be discussing student civic engagement in public service and also current policy issues in District 7 and in California. First of all, I want to say thank you very much for being here today, Assemblymember McCarty. And I have a couple of questions to get us started about how our students here at Sac State and more broadly in the CSU can get involved in public service. And I think as an alumni of the CSU system, you are uniquely qualified to answer these questions. So first up, as you probably know, many of our students are first generation scholars. Many are very interested in a career in public service, but they may not have parents or siblings or family members who hold positions similar to what they're seeking or who did internships. So knowing what you know now, what would be your advice to our undergraduates as they start their public service careers?
Great question. And first of all, thank you for having me today. As you noted, I'm an assembly member, but I'm a Sac State and Cal State Long Beach alum. So stingers up, love Sac State and love the CSU system, you know, the People's University. And you're right, it is such a diverse university that reflects what California looks like, you know, as far as Latino population, African-American, almost mirroring what we have in California. We don't have that, for example, in the UC system, but the CSU system is very, very diverse. When I was elected and sworn in, I'm just thinking about this today, when I became a public official, I guess it was 18 years ago this month, that I had a party that night with all my supporters, and I got up and gave a speech to my family and supporters. And I said, tonight, I have a new title. I'm an assembly member. They call us sometimes honorable if you're elected, the honorable. So I find that's really weird calling us honorable. But, you know, I reminded people, and frankly, I was probably reminding myself, that over the course of history, the people that have changed the world don't have fancy titles. You know, people like Martin Luther King, Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, you know, Mahatma Gandhi, Stephen Biko, the list goes on and on. They're just ordinary people doing extraordinary things. That's the first thing I want to tell young people is you don't have to have a fancy title to do something big. You know, right here in Sacramento, I know this woman named Allison Seconds. She's a local musician and an artist, had a coffee shop in Midtown. You know, she was tired of seeing all the trash on the river over the years and thought, you know, somebody should pick this stuff up. Government should be picking it up. And after years, she decided it's not happening. Let's just do it. So she started an organization called Sacramento Picks It Up. Now they have literally probably 500 people going out every month, every week, to different sites across Sacramento, just picking up trash, different locations. So, you know, people can get involved, start organizations, be part of something without having a title as an elected official. Granted, I'd love to see more CSU students and Sac State students put their name on the ballot. We had a couple that just won, seats here in Sacramento a couple of days ago. So, you know, that's exciting you know, we want people to be engaged, to vote. You know, most college students do vote more than their peers in general. But just find ways to be involved. If it's an internship for a politician, great. And there's always plenty of opportunities and people are always looking for that. You know, if it's, you know, working at a childcare center, a food bank, a senior home, you know, any other community organization that needs a helping hand, we should do so. And then lastly, not to get too sidetracked, but that's one of my missions is legislation in the coming years as to what we can do to expand, to further set in motion community service for young people. The governor just created this program, the College Corps, where he's giving some students grants and stipends to do community service. I worked on a bill this year that's doing the same thing at the high school level. But why can't we be like we have in Israel, where young people, as a condition of apart being a citizen there, they have to serve for a couple of years before they go to college. Granted, they serve in the military in Israel, but why can't we have it so, you know, college students here do some type of community service that's embedded in their academic path? So that's something that I'll be looking at this year and the years ahead as well.
Well, I think that takes me directly into my second question, and I hope I don't make you repeat yourself here, but you know, a lot of our students do work full time, and there are costs sometimes associated with, or trade-offs, you know, associated with volunteering or doing extracurriculars like internships. So how did you, or, you know, were you able to fit in those kind of experiences when you were in your undergrad or in your graduate experiences?
Yeah, no, I got lucky. I got a paid internship when I wanted to work for a local elected official when I was a student, a junior at Long Beach State. Most students don't have the opportunity. At my office, we do paid internships here and there. Not for all the interns, but we do have some that we do paid internships for. You know, that's a dilemma. Some students will have families with resources. We'll help them, subsidize them having an internship. So what would I say to those students who can't do it? You know, do what you can. Maybe you can find an internship where you can do, you know, 10 hours a week, 8 hours a week, you know, sometimes, you know, even less, maybe 7 hours a week, 2 days a week for 3.5 hours after school or something like that. And, you know, there's groups that would, organizations that would take that. And so maybe you could squeeze it in. Maybe you can't do the 20 hours a week because you have to have a part-time job, or even sometimes even a full-time job for students to take care of themselves. But maybe there are opportunities where you can do something like that. And potentially there are internships that are paid or the minimum have stipends.
Okay, and lastly, I have a bit of a two-part question here. So many of our students here on campus and throughout the CSU are very passionate student advocates. They're activists, they're advocates, and a lot of students will talk about how they have burnout. So they're working full time, they're trying to balance their academic scholarship and their activism. And so I'm kind of curious about how you potentially deal with that kind of a burnout. And I think the reason they maybe get this is they're very involved in politics, and they often mention how frustrated they are by how slowly things change. Mm-hmm. And how do you deal, perhaps as an elected official, with that feeling of working on something for a long time, but the change may be very small or incremental? So how do you, you know, advise students who are dealing with this kind of burnout when they see this like slow change?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a key issue for anybody, just patience. And it's easier said than done to have those skills. Would you attribute it to your career, your passion, your work? And young people are, you know, idealistic, and they want to see change right away. And I was like that too. I will say that in my job, and granted, I'm a little older now, so I have that, you know, vantage point. I realized that some stuff takes time. You know, I was sworn into office in December of 2014 in the assembly. And in my first 2 weeks of office, I introduced two marquee bills that I wanted to put my name on. One was having universal free preschool here in California, like many other states had. California was lagging. And I wanted to have police shootings where individuals lost their lives be investigated independently by a state Department of Justice, as opposed to local police departments, who I felt were a little bit biased. And both those bills failed the first year, failed the second year, failed the third year, the fourth year. It wasn't until my sixth year that they both became law. And so I had to introduce those bills over and over and keep plugging along. And I could have given up and said, no, it's not going to happen. But, you know, perseverance really, really matters in public policy. And sometimes it's just, you're just lucky, the right place, the right time. Like, honestly, my police reform bill, it probably would not have happened, but for the fact that the world saw George Floyd murdered on television and they saw the video, and it opened up the policy window for, you know, major criminal justice, racial justice bills to pass. Another bill on voting rights for people after they served their time in prison that it was languishing. And after that incident too, George Floyd, that bill passed. And so, you know, sometimes just a window opens up, the policy window opens up. You know, my bill for universal preschool, you know, had a tough time with a prior governor. And then when Gavin Newsom was running for governor and he talked about this as a key issue of early education, I knew this is it. We're going to make this happen. And sure enough, he got elected and a year passed. And then the economy was doing better in the budget, and we were able to have a major, major lift to make this $3 billion commitment for California a reality. So, you know, you just have to push along, and every once in a while, like, the sunshine comes out and you're ready to go, but you have to be in the game for that to happen.
Thank you very much. I think that's a perfect transition over to Professor Teller. I think he wants to discuss in some more detail some public policy issues.
Yes, thank you again, Assemblymember McCarty, for joining us. We couldn't let you go without at least asking you about some of your legislative agenda, past, present, future. And so some of what you've already mentioned, I would love to discuss further with you. This second part of the podcast offers an opportunity to discuss legislative and policy issues in the Sacramento region and the state at large. Considering your recent policy focus in education, police and criminal justice reform, and environmental protection, let's start with a discussion of these issues, if you don't mind.
Great.
So, first question, as we approach the end of 2022, there are a few key legislative victories when it comes to education policy, mostly having to do with higher education. Yet what will most likely be the most talked about policy victory in this realm comes with the implementation of universal kindergarten across the state. Can you just take a moment to talk about some of the educational policy you've been working on and sort of discuss what comes next in this policy realm?
Yeah, well, I've been working on expanding public education access and quality for all students and all ages, from our youngest students in early ed to K-12 to higher education. We know this is a knowledge-based economy. We know that education matters as far as economic mobility. It also matters for our economy. You know, we need more graduates to fill the jobs of today and tomorrow. You know, unfortunately, we have to go recruit people from India sometimes to fill these jobs and these tech jobs because we don't have enough people here, which is a double whammy because, you know, the people here who don't take those jobs in some of our communities are left behind and stuck in careers that, you know, don't pay living wages and, you know, perpetuate poverty and intergenerational poverty. So, being that, I did some research and looked at what other researchers were saying as far as education, what we can make a difference. And the common denominator for years was the early education matters. It was one thing that you could do to change the outcome of people in school. It's making sure there's a, you know, people start the same place when they enter kindergarten. That starts with kindergarten readiness and early ed. And some kids get it and some kids don't. And you can literally see and track the kids in first, second, and the finally third grade in their reading scores by the ones who had early ed and did not. So, and the one of the reasons why I was successful in this, because I didn't tie it necessarily on a moral issue and value, but some of the sticky issues that we're trying to address in California. If you look at things like breaking cycles of intergenerational poverty, if you look at the school to prison pipeline and criminal justice, and, you know, it's the school issues, the achievement gap, the opportunity gap, you know, preschool was the proven difference maker And so some of the most powerful witnesses I had when I pushed my preschool for all bill through wasn't a kindergarten teacher or preschool teacher. It was a local police chief or a local DA. You know, our local DA here, Anne-Marie Schubert, who didn't agree on a lot of things on the criminal justice side and police reform, she was my star witness. She came in the committee room and said, hey, if you want fewer kids in the juvenile justice system, you know, you need to have more kids in state preschool programs. And so that really enabled us to open some eyes through my colleagues, and we got it across the finish line.
Yeah, it seems like the equitable aspect of early childhood education shines through, especially after the COVID-19 pandemic, where reports suggest that those in lower income stratas or living in underrepresented communities, you know, educationally felt the impact extremely harsh when it came to missing school time or having to move remotely. And so this seems to also work within that aspect of trying to uplift the communities hit hardest in the wake of COVID as well.
Absolutely.
100%. Right, in addition to education, you had mentioned working with law enforcement and the justice system. In terms of police and criminal justice reform, AB 1443 and AB 1191, having to do with community policing and firearms tracing, stand out as immensely important legislative victories in the last year or two. However, it seems to have been a bit more difficult to push through legislation that works towards police transparency, such as policy working towards use of force payouts or reporting of deaths from public service agencies, and the implementation of additional police training, such as bias training. With this topic, can you kind of discuss the progress made and why certain issues might have been able to been pushed through in the last couple of years and others might have more of an uphill battle?
Yeah, you know, you can't get them all, you know, but I think that we've been able to enact some significant police reforms. And we should talk about the glass being, I would say, 3/4 full and not, you know, a quarter empty. So I think that there's four that just top of my head jump out. One is a bill I worked on, I think, 4 years ago. Dr. Weber was a lead author. I was their joint author with her on our use of force bill and changing the standards as far as when officers could legally shoot and kill somebody. Changed it from a reasonable standard, which is very subjective from the eyes of what another police officer do, to, you know, when necessary. And so that also changed training in law enforcement. So we've seen that there's been fewer incidents of fatalities with more training. Then the bill that I did 2 years later that focused on who does these investigations. It's no longer the police policing themselves, which just doesn't make any sense. Now the attorney general is doing these, and he has a batch of them. He's about to come to conclusions right now. And, you know, the idea isn't to, you know, have a bunch more people prosecuted. Maybe, maybe not. It's about fairness and accountability when an officer does cross the line. Two other bills that I think are important in the police reform space the last couple of years. One on police records, to make sure that those records are now public, and Senator Skinner pushed for that. And then in a last year, which I think is such a key issue, the title of the bill, but I'll describe it to you. It's when police officers get fired for, crossing the line from some small police department, and then they bounce around to other departments. And so this kind of stops that practice. So I think in totality, you know, these things are making a major difference. So we had, you know, some other ones too that were in the mix. So I proud of the work that we've done, but we're not done. Like you said too, there's a couple of bills that I authored, you know, publicizing how much we pay out. I think if people knew how much we paid out, you know, every year for these, abusing individuals with too much excessive force, you know, sometimes they make the front page of the newspaper, sometimes they don't. So I think that the public deserves to know that. And once they do know that, they'll demand more appropriate action from their police force and training and so forth. So, you know, the issue's not going to go away, and we'll keep on it. But again, proud of the stuff that we've done in California the last few years on this topic.
Yeah, you say there's more work to do. if you could pick the next sort of legislative victory in this area, in this policy area, what do you think you would want to see happen next regarding sort of police and criminal justice reform?
On police reform, I think we've got a lot that we can do. There are some, you know, some tweaks in here. I think the real thing that for criminal justice reform, you know, California, we've really done a lot after the incarceration decade of the 80s and 90s, last 10 years to have sentencing reform and have some smart, you know, policy changes to, you know, work on stemming the school to prison pipeline for so many people in so many communities. I think the big thing now is we need to focus on how do we help people succeed once they get out of the criminal justice system. You know, so I wrote laws and created policies on, you know, employment, you know, the ban the box law, you know, restoring voting rights, college access through my Rising Scholars program to help CSU and community college students enter the system after incarceration. But there's still hurdles in housing and other things as well. So I think that focusing on the reentry side is the way to really address recidivism. And now we're getting pushed back from the other side that our reforms went too far. And so, you know, I think that, you know, we need to think about other things that we do, like drug treatment. Do we make sure that people who enter the criminal justice system, and frankly, their crimes are being fed by their addiction to drugs, are we helping them when they're incarcerated and helping them address their root issues? So when they get out, that, you know, they've addressed some of those addiction issues. So there's a sweet spot that we're going to have to navigate. And again, you know, the mood of the people of California determines that as well. Like I said earlier, the policy window 4 years ago after George Floyd for the police reforms. Now we're seeing a lot of our communities, you know, are concerned. We want to make sure that we have policies that make sense. And so we'll be working on that. And I'm quite certain this year and the next couple of years as well.
Yes, absolutely agree. The criminal justice system has always been a slippery slope from reform to removal. It definitely seems like the last 5 or 6 years or so, the latter rather than the former has been emphasized. Mm-hmm. I'd like to also ask you about some of your work you've done in environmental protection and environmental policy. With your legislative agenda focusing most recently on sort of electric vehicles, EVs, and working toward air quality and climate goals for the state, can you maybe respond to concerns about how sort of the power grid across the state, a grid already stretched thin due to difficulties with things such as summer heat, can handle sort of this push towards EVs and the creation of a charging infrastructure?
Yeah, no, I'm really proud of what California has done in the environmental world, tackling climate change, you know, real local issues like air pollution. You know, we need to address this from the global perspective, of course, but California has been leading the way. And these things aren't going to happen overnight. So yeah, I'm a big, you know, supporter and champion of, you know, tackling this through, you know, the biggest driver of bad air and our, you know, climate challenges, automobiles, mobile sources. And so how do you do that? You know, get clean cars. And so, you know, I worked on legislation, authored it, and it was codified this year by the State Air Resources Board that sets California on a path by 2030 to have 100% clean cars as far as cars sold. And so that gives us a multi-year on-ramp to make it happen. It's not going to happen overnight. These are just new cars. So there'll be existing cars on the road for, you know, maybe a decade or two after that as well. And so I'm pleased so far what we've been able to do with infrastructure and charging infrastructure, but it's going to basically be a phased in approach. Yeah, we are going to have to step up and look at the grid capacity of California. That's a challenge, but I see that less of a challenge than doing nothing and having our environment go to crap and you not having a sustainable world for the next generation. So it's a challenge and a risk that I'll take, because the flip side is way, way worse with rising temperatures and the impact on fires and floods and all the catastrophic impacts with climate change. So I think we just need to stay the course, but there's work to be done. I've done a few bills to help make it easier, to streamline, to pay for charging infrastructure. You know, I think people who have resources, they can figure it out, like a lot of things in life, people with money. But what happens to people who live in apartments? Well, you know, what do they charge? Right now, you know, 3/4 of the people that have electric cars charge at home. You can plug in to your house and you know, charge your car roughly the full thing overnight without getting one of the fancy chargers that cost hundreds of dollars, just using your traditional plug in your garage. But some people live in apartments, and how do they do that? So, you know, we do have to sort these things out, but I'm confident that we'll rise to the challenge.
Then the issues with the regional power grid have sort of plagued California for a while. And so if this is an area for which those issues can be highlighted once more and dealt with, it can only benefit the state in the long run.
Yeah, the governor signed another one of my bills last year, which does just that, which has the Energy Commission utilities look at data and analyze what's been happening so far in this electric space as far as charging and basically planning out where to go in the coming years.
Additionally, are there other areas you or your colleagues are working with that are aiming to progress sort of environmental policy when it comes to climate change, such as other areas that contribute to greenhouse gas emissions nearly as much as transportation, areas like electrical power or industrial discharges and waste?
Yeah, I think one of the ongoing issues that we're doing is focusing on, you know, not just our overall environment, but how certain communities feel this. So environmental justice movement. I know this firsthand. When I was a council member, there was a big, you know, corporation that wanted to basically create an underground natural gas storage tanks and, you know, caverns under a neighborhood. And guess what the neighborhood looked like? It wasn't the rich neighborhood of Fab 40 Sacramento or Land Park, Natomas. It was the lower income Southeast Sacramento, where 80% of the residents were Black and Brown and lower income Southeast Asian. And so, you know, that's what happens. And so, you know, we are working on that from a statewide level. And I think that that's key. The bill we passed last year on wells, oil wells next to neighborhoods, having adequate distance buffers. I think that's a key piece of the puzzle as well. So, we've really stretched the last 10 years on the environment in California with our policies. And I think right now is a lot of just implementing those pieces. But, you know, we will continue to see what we can do to make a difference for Californians for a greener future.
Yeah, absolutely. As we come to sort of the conclusion of our discussion, I'd like to ask about a policy issue that's been on my mind recently, and then give you a chance to discuss anything you believe is important or you would like to speak to before we finish. For me, the state of California has sort of once again taken the lead when it comes to progressive policy, this time when it comes to reparations for Black Americans. In an executive summary report created as part of AB 3121's task force, and the push to examine the potential reparations in the state of California, findings proclaim the racial wealth gap between white and Black households are the same today as it had been 2 years before the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964. And specifically in the city of Los Angeles, the median value of liquid assets for Black Americans' household is a mere $200 compared to $110,000 for white households. The report goes on to recommend the implementation of a detailed program of reparations for Black Californians, yet kind of does little to provide real concrete examples of policy reform that are not universal in their application. For example, sort of free mental health services for all Californians. So in your opinion, reparations for Black Californians are a real possibility in the near future? And do you see such a policy attempting to provide resources as focused racial policy or more as universal policy intended to help Black people in sort of disproportionate ways?
Yeah, no, I'm proud that we were able to lean in and start this national discussion on reparations. And again, like I said earlier, it was the policy window that made this happen. You know, but for that summer of George Floyd in 2020, that COVID year, this bill would not have passed. You know, ethnic studies would not have passed. My voting rights bill would not have passed. The police reforms passed. So I think the lens for this is crystal clear. Now, I did another bill on the racial covenants of people, property in California, and how the redlining had an impact on where people could buy homes. And this really is this whole thing with reparations. So after, you know, the civil rights era and allowed, you know, African Americans to buy homes, you know, they bought neighborhoods that didn't have the same appreciation. And so this has a generational impact. So it takes real a deep dive to figure out how we can make a difference in these issues. Like here in Sacramento, we've given licenses, for example, for marijuana, for the cannabis industry, to individuals and communities that were impacted by the war on drugs. So predominantly a lot of African-American communities. But giving somebody a license to open a dispensary is useless unless they have basically connections to borrow money, to open the business, to start it. And so you can't just give somebody a paper and say, good luck, go at it. And you know, a year later, the business will never really have taken off. And so there are so many intricate pieces of this. And we're gonna have to take a look. What does that mean? Is it access to higher education, resources, you know, how does this play into with new laws that are coming down the books too, potentially coming off the books across America as far as affirmative action and racial policy? So like there are many pieces of the puzzle, but I think the biggest thing, and not just to minimize, you know, the outcomes of this, is that we're actually talking about it. That we're having a process to bring up these potential solutions. So I'm optimistic that we're able to really reflect back on the history of our country and how the impacts, you know, 100 years later, sometimes or more, are still a reality in too many communities across California.
Californians should definitely stand tall and taking the lead on this policy front. I think some takeaways that come to mind from this conversation is not only the legislative agenda that you've taken on and you've pushed for and accomplished so far, but also the role that citizens in historical moments play. And there is a real connection that you've made clear between what's going on a grassroots level in the communities and how those movements, social movements, protests can influence law and can actually create contexts, political and environmental contexts that facilitate lawmaking in ways that wouldn't otherwise be possible. So it's great to hear that connection come to life in your own experiences.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Lastly, are there any other issues or topics that you'd like to discuss or sort of make our listeners aware of before we conclude this podcast?
Well, your listeners, in addition to all these other issues, are interested in going to college, regardless of their major and their passion. So that is one of my top priorities and one of the things I'm really going to be zeroing in on my last 4 years in the legislature is college access and college affordability. I made significant strides in this. We have in California. I'm looking to continue efforts to expand financial aid through our Cal Grant program, our middle-class scholarship program, to make college truly debt-free in California. You know, there's a debate at the national level for a free college. Some of our progressive congressional members, Bernie Sanders, AOC, you know, talk about that. That'd be great. I'm not sure if it's realistic. I'm not sure if it really makes sense. I don't know if my kids, you know, I'd like to have free college for them, but you know, I'd rather have California use those scarce dollars to maybe expand financial aid for people that need a bit more. And so that's what we're looking about doing, not having free college, but debt free. What does that mean? It means that college students can get their Cal Grant, pay their share based upon their family income. You know, let's say work 15 hours a week and get an additional grant on top of the Cal Grant, and they could literally graduate without any debt. And then they could, you know, enter the workforce and get a job and be able to potentially buy a house and, you know, live the American dream without being saddled with $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 or more if you're a professor like your level in debt. So that is my big college quest. The governor is open to it. UC is already talking about this as well as the CSU system. So stay tuned for that, for our big debt-free college proposal. I'll be introducing a simple version of the bill when we start the session this month, and we'll be expanding upon the details of what it looks like in the coming months.
Right. Well, absolutely stay tuned, and catching that you said your final 4 years in office. So we thank you for your long career of service. And we would just want to thank Assemblymember McCarty for taking the time to talk with us today. And we want to thank you for listening. We hope our ongoing conversations spark understandings, empathies, and motivation to join the struggle for a better future for all.
All the penalties and the rewards based on the actions. Now, time for building justice. Building justice. Time for